This is the third, or maybe either the third of a three-part series or the second series on national healthcare. The one today is entitled Our U.S. Healthcare System, Justice and Sustainability. And since the format is perhaps a little bit freewheeling here, why don't we go ahead and start with your question.
Maybe it'll come into this. I think you referred to it yesterday, but I didn't catch the statistics. How much do you think the rise in medical health, not medical health, but medical prices is due to people that sue for malpractice?
Okay. Probably not a whole lot, but a little bit. Certainly a significant portion of United States physicians' aggravation factor, if you will, is due to malpractice. And there are definitely some economic consequences of of excessive amounts of malpractice litigation in this country. But I think that one of the features that is primarily driving the rise in medical costs, although it certainly is factoring in. I mean, part of the problem with this question is there are a number of things that factor into the economics of it, and it's real hard to tease out all the minor elements, but I think that's not one of the major players. Go ahead.
Consumer Reports did a pretty exhaustive study of the medical system. Either early this year or late
last
year.
I think it was January or so. Right?
And in their opinion, it was about 1% of the cost of insurance and all of that contributed to our health care dollar expenditure. About 20%, they suggested, was due to duplication, fraud, waste, things like that.
Administrative, sort of a rubric to lump all that under is administrative waste, both legitimate administrative waste and also perhaps a small degree illegitimate administrative or illegal, if you will, administrative
waste.
Good question. Well, maybe we should go through the slides, and I can try and answer that a little more, because some of that I think we went through on the first day, and I'll see if I can throw that out again here. So some of these earlier slides, for those of you who, I guess I need a projector screen. For those of you who were here on the first day, a lot of these earlier ones you're going to have seen. For those of you who were here yesterday, a lot of the, just flip them all down there, please. Thanks. A lot of the, somehow I didn't get that on still. I seem to have, no matter how many times I try it out or set it up ahead of time, I still have problems with this projector. Oh, here we go. Okay. All right. Okay, as I've suggested before, especially on Wednesday, there are two components to what is frequently called the healthcare crisis in this country. And in my opinion, the more important component of that is the moral crisis, the crisis of now 35 million individuals who really have no financial access at all to the healthcare system. And I think this is the fundamental thing that as a church and as Christians that we should be focusing on. Although the other half of the problem is the economic aspects of it, and I certainly think that those are worth looking at as well. First, just some components of the moral aspect of this. The number of uninsured Americans, as we saw before, is rising at a fairly quick pace as compared to the 70s. It's now about twice as many individuals as it was in the mid-70s. If you look at it in a different way, that is to say individuals who were uninsured for at least 1 month during a 2.5-year review by the Census Bureau during the late 80s, they found that perhaps a quarter of all Americans were uninsured for at least a month. And part of this is accounted for the fact that when people lose jobs, switch jobs, move to different parts of the country, go from school to job, for example, they lose their insurance for a period of time. This doesn't happen in countries that have universal access. The problem of uninsurance hits hardest on children, on the poor, and both the poor who are employed, that is to say, those who are employed in relatively low salaried or low compensation occupations. 7% of the uninsured are unemployed. In addition, as we talked about the other day, the lack of financial access to the healthcare system also hits hardest on racial minorities. Hispanics have twice the degree of uninsurance and inability to access the system as white Americans do. And also, the problem is to some extent a problem of the underinsured as well, those who have partial coverage. We talked about the fact that Medicare pays only about less than half of seniors' total medical bills, and that on the average, senior citizens in this country pay about 18% or so of their after-tax income in out-of-pocket costs, which is a considerable rise over a decade ago. And in addition, there are a large number of young women in childbearing ages who have no insurance that covers prenatal care. As a consequence of this lack of financial access and large number of individuals without insurance, we have a number of problems. 300,000 individuals per year in this country that are turned away from emergency rooms. This is the chart, which I showed a number of you before, of a young woman who was in a motor vehicle accident, was taken by ambulance to the emergency room of a private hospital, and then was summarily transferred from there to a public hospital in the same town, as it says on the top of this chart, because she had no insurance. The chart goes on to diagram for all of her medical problems, including massive internal bleeding for which she required a very prolonged and major surgery, and subsequently had significant medical consequences that at least in part were due to the delay. And this is a story that is repeated time and time again in public hospital emergency rooms and public hospital wards all over the country.
She was turned away from a private?
From a private hospital because she lacked ability to pay, and was therefore seen at the public hospital in the city, but the delay was a problem for her. For the most part, public hospitals, you know, have a mandate to care for whoever comes in through the door, but there are problems with that. First, many places don't have public hospitals, and second, most public hospitals are underfunded and overburdened, so they just cannot handle the incredible onslaught of individuals who need their help.
So it's turned her away.
Yeah. It's interesting that in the town in which this, it's a different town. I read the other day that vignette from the May issue of Sojourners about the young man with diabetes who was removed from a church hospital in Tennessee by the hospital administrator because he had been unable to pay his bills for previous hospitalizations, previous admissions, and subsequently died because of the lack of medical care. Well, in most cities that have several church-sponsored or at least private hospitals that were originally founded by church groups. The public emergency rooms in those hospitals, if there's a county hospital, have reported from several different places in the country that they get dumps like this, as it's called in the medical literature, from each of those church hospitals. So in other words, church hospitals, or church-supported hospitals, or at least church-founded hospitals, are really no different than other private hospitals, at least in many cities, in terms of how they now regard people's ability to pay. To some degree, that's not the case. To some degree, church hospitals still have a certain pool of money out of which they can draw to provide, quote, charitable care. But once they exhaust that pool, then church hospital administrators often act not quite so blatantly as in that story for the Sojourners, but essentially bar their doors in the same way. So private hospitals, both nonprofit charitable church hospitals and also for-profit private hospitals, to some degree tend to do the same thing.
It seems to be the kind of thing where a woman might actually bring litigation.
Well,
because of the delay, she was...
I think one could say that, but unfortunately there's a lot of protection for, since we have a system that's based on ability to pay, it's pretty difficult to bring those kind of lawsuits. And generally before emergency rooms do this kind of transfer, as they call it, they have to sort of provide some minimal, a certification that they've stabilized the patient. One emergency room's definition of stability and another's may be different, and their definition of stability may be that the blood pressure is not rapidly falling and going to zero, but that may not mean that the patient cannot benefit from more urgent surgery.
Well, this is a stupid question, but I mean, if this woman is coming in this condition, for example, how is it that they know that she doesn't have insurance?
She failed the wallet biopsy, sometimes.
Well, I mean, some of us don't carry our little cards with us, but sure. We really do have insurance. I mean, what would stop her from just lying?
Well,
or even that
I think that's a potential problem. I mean, what emergency rooms usually do is if you come in and you're able to walk or talk, or at least somehow make account of yourself, or somebody who's with you is, then the first question that they get asked is, what is your insurance coverage, or what kind of financial coverage do you have? The second question usually is these days, what's wrong with you, at least in private hospital emergency rooms. And it's true that there's some individuals that are not going to be able to answer that question. Apparently this young woman did, either by virtue of having a relative or somebody with her who knew what her situation was, or else, as I said, hospitals do wallet biopsies. They look through the wallet and see, if there's something there that indicates that there's probably insurance coverage. So, sad but true. Other consequences besides emergency room rejections or transfers. Lack of preventive care, we talked about. These are tests that are quite well established to be effective preventive measures that go along with annual exams for women in middle ages. Things like blood pressure checks and pelvic exams with a pap smear, breast exams to detect early breast cancer at a point when it's more likely to be curable, and checks for glaucoma to preserve vision. And it's clear that individuals who are uninsured are less likely to get those kind of services on a regular basis than individuals who are insured. As a consequence, in addition, as I said on Wednesday, in this country we share two features with South Africa. One is that of 14 or 15 developed countries that have been well surveyed, we're really the only one along, or the only South Africa and the United States are the only two, I'm sorry, that provide no universal health coverage. And the other feature is that we're really the only two countries that do not keep aggregate health statistics by socioeconomic status. So instead, in this country at least, we're somewhat compelled to use health statistics kept by race as sort of a surrogate for socioeconomic status. We certainly know that a higher proportion of African Americans are below poverty level than Caucasian Americans, for example. We know that a higher proportion of Black Americans have more or have no access to healthcare or no financial access, and therefore, to some degree, the public health statistics for Black versus white Americans can be used as a marker to some degree of the consequences of our healthcare system. And this shows that Black women with prenatal care is still a problem. It was a decreasing problem during the 60s and 70s, and then during the late 80s started to climb again. Our infant mortality ratio in Black children is starting to climb again. And as you can see, the disparity between Black and white infants in terms of mortality rate is increasing as well. We have a infant mortality rate overall for the entire population that's significantly worse than a number of other developed countries. Mortality rate among racial minorities is higher in this country than it is among whites, and that's particularly the case for Black females, and at least a portion of the higher mortality for Black females is due to the lack of maternity care. And again, these numbers were improving during the 1970s, stabilized some during the early 80s, but then actually have been creeping up in the last few years again, so things are getting worse.
What's the cause of death?
Well, this is actually an aggregate cause of death among all Black females, so some of the excess mortality suggested by this graph is because of maternity-related complications, but there are other causes of excess mortality, including things like poor control of hypertension, poor control of diabetes, poor control or poor lower rates of early detection of breast cancer, etc. So there are a number of causes for this. Both for men and for women in this country, we have a lower life expectancy than is the case for essentially almost all other developed countries. The numbers look a little better for women down at the lower end of the scale. I think the U.S. is second to the bottom for women, but for men, we're right down there at the bottom among this aggregate of nations, which is comparable in a number of other respects. Some of the countries that are left off this scale are, for example, the Scandinavian countries, which, of course, do much better than we do. Countries like Netherlands, Belgium, etc., which also are closer to Japan than they are to the United States. So, and this statistic or slide, which always seems quite stark to me, that at any age past 40, men in Harlem, Black men in Harlem have a, well, essentially, they are going to be all Black, have a lower survival rate than men in Bangladesh. Now, of course, this isn't.
The question on that,
yeah.
Is are violent deaths included in this?
Yeah, they are. That's a good question. I mean, certainly there's a number of other things besides, strictly speaking, access to healthcare that goes into this statistic. But at the upper ends of the curve, you know, up at ages greater than, let's say, 25 or 30, violent deaths are a decreasing proportion of the difference, and deaths due to negligence or lack of access to health care are going to be an increasing proportion of it. So, you know, some of the fact that that this is a more precipitous curve in here is probably due to violent deaths. Obviously, this part of the curve is due to low or higher infant mortality in Bangladesh than it is in Harlem, although this is a fairly significant infant mortality if you look at it as compared to the United States as a whole. So, and I also mentioned on Wednesday that, as you, I think, suggested as well, that there are other features that are involved in these health statistics. And if you look at health in the aggregate, that is to say, as being a combination of physical, social, and mental factors, there are a number of other things to take into account. And so poverty, housing, jobs, education, things like that are certainly issues when we talk about health in this country. And this just is to indicate that to some degree we had some success with the social programs of the 60s. Poverty dropped in this country. It's been rising in the 1980s and in the early 90s, and that is compounding our health access problems as well. The other half of the crisis in the U.S. healthcare system is the economic aspect of it. And as this indicates, our costs for health expenditure are on an exponential rise. They've doubled since 1985. Now they're at $820 billion per year. And that's expected to double again in the next 5 to 7 years. The percentage of our gross national product that we spend on health in this country is 13%+ versus the 8.7%, I think it is now, in Canada. This actually suggests that in 1990 it was up to 9. I think that was actually a projected figure, and it never really hit 9% in Canada. I just realized, never noticed that about the slide before now. But anyway, most developed countries have stabilized their healthcare spending as a percentage of gross national product at 8 to 9%. The United States, on the other hand, continues to rise. In 1985, our percentage of gross national product that we were spending in healthcare was 10.5%, and now it's up to 13.3%. Is that right? 13.5%. I'm a little muddled on my statistics here at the moment. Some other aspects of the economic crisis of healthcare in this country is that it's having significant effects on our productivity and probably on our global competitiveness. About three-quarters of all strikes in the last decade, all labor disputes in the last decade, included health benefits as a significant bone of contention. And this study was done to compare the costs of health benefits for employees per car in the United States versus that in other developed countries that have significant auto manufacturing capacities. In the United States, comparing Chrysler, which probably has the most efficient auto manufacturing system in this country at present, the cost per car was approximately three times that in Canada. Actually, is sort of an interesting, not particularly useful, but interesting statistic that U.S. automobiles now contain more health care or more health benefits per car than they do steel. So I think that's kind of, I don't think that's probably fair economics, but at least it's kind of interesting. We pay more for prescription drug prices in this country than do countries with single payer plans or single payer access programs. For example, Britain and Canada. Canada pays 60% of the price that the United States consumers pay for exactly the same drugs. And that's partly because they've got a mechanism for negotiating with pharmaceutical manufacturers to keep excess profiteering down in drug prices. We also have a problem in this country with excess capacity and maldistribution of our capacity. As a example of that, here's a few empty stretchers in a hospital, and there are tens of thousands of empty hospital beds in this country. Most hospitals in this country do not run at anything better than 80% census on the average per year, which means that there's a significant excess there. Now, any hospital is going to need a certain amount of excess, the same way that Holden Village has a certain amount of excess, or you know, it run into people not having a place to stay on occasion. But it does, but we do not need the kind of hospital bed excess that we have in this country. I'm sorry.
Is that where you have legitimate waste coming in? Well, I would think if somebody decides cots, quote blue stuff, which may not be used for a couple of days, but it's there, everybody wants it there.
That's right. I guess, you know, the term legitimate waste wasn't necessarily what I should have said. What I meant was legal waste. Okay. The distinction that Mike was making, or one of the things that he said, was that the Consumer Reports had said that about 20% of our healthcare cost in this country is due to administrative waste, including fraud. And I don't consider fraud to be administrative waste, or at least legitimate administrative waste. I consider that to be illegal or illegitimate administrative waste. I think that's a fairly small part of our problem, truthfully. And you know, in the grand scheme of things, fraud isn't a major issue. It certainly ought to be taken. You know, it's certainly something that we need to keep watching for and take care of where it's there. But it's not a major economic issue, I don't think. But I consider that illegitimate waste in the term that I was using before, or perhaps better called illegal waste. This is perfectly legal, and under our current system, it's considered to be legitimate. But I think it's a problem. That makes sense?
Where would you put overpricing?
I think depends on what kind of overpricing. Some types of overpricing are not at present categorizable. I mean, for example, this sort of overpricing on prescription drug prices, you know, are not really included in any of the calculations that people use for, you know, excess cost in this country. It's something that's pretty hard to sort of factor into a global budget. But certainly, if we had a single payer system, we would be gaining some savings on this, I think, that haven't really been, you know, factored into most people's calculations. There's different types of overpricing by different, you know, components of the system. Hospital overpricing, I think, for the most part, is factored into calculations on administrative waste. It's easy to compare one hospital to another, and to take hospitals as an aggregate and compare those to hospitals as an aggregate in other countries in terms of how much they spend, you know, between their operating expenses and that are used strictly for patient care and their operating expenses that include patient care plus administration. And overpricing by physicians, you know, essentially, at least physicians that are practicing in private practice and fee for service, there really is no such thing at this point. You know, overpricing is not a concept when you're dealing with a market system. I mean, overpricing is what, or pricing is what the market bears.
And And the insurance for doctors has gone up tremendously.
Malpractice insurance? Yeah. That's true.
You said that overall is the case.
Well, I mean, I think it has gone up. I'm not saying it's not a significant problem. I don't think it's a major problem in terms of the macroeconomics of the whole thing. It's certainly a bone of contention for physicians, and it certainly is putting the squeeze on certain types of positions in some ways, but it's probably not a major part of our national healthcare economic crisis. There's some of these problems that you need to think about maybe in terms of what they represent as a problem for the individual physician, let's say, or the individual patient, as opposed to what they represent for the system as a whole. Mm-hmm. And I think for the system as a whole, that's not a major component of the problem, but it is, perhaps a minor component. Another major component of the economic crisis is duplication of technology, or perhaps a better way of describing it is maldistribution of technology. I gave this example before that in Iowa and Des Moines, there are two hospitals that do kidney transplants, whereas 100 miles away in Iowa City, there is a much larger university hospital that is much better set up to do kidney transplants and does a lot more. And the surgical teams that these two smaller hospitals in Des Moines maintain to do kidney transplants, the sort of equipment that they need to do transplants, is probably truthfully a waste. That's stuff that would not have to be spent. The university hospital could probably absorb the extra 23 cases that those two smaller hospitals in Des Moines did in 1988. Without much excess capitalization costs. So that's just one sort of concrete example of maldistribution of technology. One of the things that's interesting is that in a market system, it seems that healthcare organizations, hospitals for example, can compete to some degree on the basis of services that they can offer. They don't compete on price or economic efficiency. Instead, they compete on the basis of sort of extras. You know, how broad spectrum is their service? What kind of high-tech things can they do? And that's what hospitals tend to advertise. They also compete to some extent, at least in terms of the public, what they advertise in commercials on the basis of quality. But in practice, they probably are instead competing for smaller segments of the population that needs specialized services, things like transplants, dialysis, high-tech newborn care, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's a lot of excess in our medical system of these sorts of high technology things. Another good example of that is mammography, for example. It's estimated that there are 10,000 mammogram machines in this country. Now, mammography is something that, is recommended for a significant segment of the female adult population to be done on a regular basis. So clearly that's a preventive healthcare modality that we need to be using, and we need to be using more of. But at the present time, there are 10,000 mammography machines plus, people to run them set up around the country. It's estimated that if we consolidated those resources in some sort of regional way, that probably we would only need 2,000 of those machines to handle the current demand, and that if every woman who was recommended to get a mammogram on a regular basis did so in this country, we would probably only need 5,000 machines. So what that means is that there are a lot of mammography machines that are remaining idle for a lot of the time in this country. And one of the other consequences of that is that it probably compromises the quality that women who are getting mammograms receive from places that do a relatively small number of them per machine. And we talked also about the fact that some high-tech surgical and other sort of intervention procedures may be overused in this country. We also talked about one of the other features of the economic crisis, and that is that a significant difference between the United States and Canada, which is the second the country which spends the second highest amount per capita on healthcare. A lot of that difference is in terms of how much we spend on bureaucracy or medical administration. And to illustrate those, in hospitals, we have a very cumbersome billing system in almost every hospital in the country now, where every little jot and tittle, every little piece of equipment, every little procedure, every little bag of intravenous medication, etc., is billed individually, as indicated by the billing tags on this nurse's uniform. And therefore, the United States spends a lot more per person on hospital billing than does Canada, which has a much more simple unified single-payer system. The same is the case for clinic expenses, physicians' offices. We spend a lot more for paperwork and administration in physicians' hospitals or physicians' offices per capita in this country. And the same is the case for insurance. We spend a lot on administration of insurance in this country. One other feature of this is that we also spend a lot more on advertising of prescription medications to physicians in this country. This is an ad that's appeared for several years now in a number of medical journals. Just about any physician in the country who reads general medical journals would recognize this ad. And this is fascinating because this is real sandpaper that they've got right here to show how these bones grind together and how you should be taking this drug to relieve your aches and the physician should be prescribing this drug to relieve the aches and pains of their patients. It's a good drug. I don't want to knock the drug, but the advertising is expensive. And it's estimated that probably per physician that at least $5,000 per year is spent on this kind of advertising in this country. That's an incredible expense. One more aspect of, in a sense, administrative waste or some sort of expense that in Canada is not anywhere near as high because there's a more tightly controlled system of purchasing of pharmaceuticals. Okay, the two key proposals for changing the system, as we talked about yesterday, are employer mandate proposals and single payer system proposals. And yesterday I actually listed four different proposals. The other two that I'm not really going to talk about much today are a conservative free market approach proposed by the Heritage Foundation, among other organizations, that essentially is a voucher system. What you do is you give the amount of money that individuals are being, that employers, for example, are spending on employees' health care now, you give that directly to the employee or to the family unit and have them go out into the marketplace and buy their own insurance. And for individuals that are unemployed, they get a tax credit or some sort of public financed voucher, similar to what the administration has been proposing for education financing. And Bush's system is sort of a watered-down version of that. What I have somewhat malevolently called tax tinkering. Essentially, Bush is proposing a voluntary system that includes tax credits for those who are currently not insured. There's some significant problems with it, and I think it's probably not politically doing very well, and I don't consider them serious reform proposals, truthfully. So I'm going to concentrate on the two versions of reform that I think are the most serious and really address, make a reasonable attempt at addressing some of the issues. One of them is clustered under the general title of employer mandate proposals, or otherwise known as play or pay proposals. And there's been a number of versions of this on the Democratic leadership of the Senate, or of the Congress, has proposed one not only this year but also last 2 years ago. The Pepper Commission, which was headed by Senator John Rockefeller, had a similar proposal. The AMA has provided something similar, although not exactly as strong as these two. And then there's a group called the National Leadership Coalition on Healthcare, which includes several physicians, professional organizations, a number of large corporations, several labor unions, and some other large organizations in the country who have proposed a similar employer mandate type system. It's interesting to note that actually President Nixon proposed a sort of similar system back in 1974, which was did not go anywhere at that time. And Massachusetts tried such a system back in 1988, but it didn't work, and it was quickly repealed within a year or so. A key features of this kind of proposal is that employers are required to either provide coverage, health insurance coverage for their employees, or else they pay an extra tax if they don't want to provide that kind of coverage. And that tax is then used to finance individuals who are not covered by their employers. And as currently proposed in the congressional bills that are in the hopper, there are significant exceptions for small businesses or new businesses, significant exceptions for part-time workers or for seasonal workers, like, for example, migrant farm workers. So there would continue to be a significant number of individuals who would be exempted under this system. And then to take care of all of those, or most of those, depending on which of the particular bills you look at, who are not covered by their employers, these proposals would expand Medicaid or would roll Medicaid into a slightly larger program of perhaps a different name to cover all the remaining uninsured. One of the features of this would be that it would still use almost all private insurance companies for this, and there would be one probably public program for this. Some of the best proposals include attempts to reform the insurance system so that small businesses and self-employed individuals can buy health insurance at rates that are available to individuals who are part of larger employee pools. And as a way of attempting to control costs, most of these proposals would expand the use of HMOs or managed care programs. The advantages of this would be that, for the most part, these are relatively universal proposals, at least the best ones are. And so it really would take care of some of the moral problems of the health care crisis. Another advantage, in many people's view, is that it's financed by premiums. That is to say, it's primarily employer-based, so it doesn't involve as much manipulation of the tax structure. and the political advantage of it is that private health insurance companies would stand to gain by this, if anything, and so they're in favor of it and are strongly pushing it, and they're a politically potent lobby. The disadvantages is that it would not take care of underinsurance at all. In addition, in most of these proposals, there would be some percentage, relatively small percentage of Americans that would fall through the cracks. That really doesn't have anything to control the increased administrative costs of our present reimbursement system. And There are usually, there's not much in these proposals that at least convinces me that cost control would be particularly effective. The closest that these proposals come to controlling overall costs is by increasing managed care, but I think looking at the record of HMOs, it's not altogether clear to me that HMOs control costs that well. The difference between the cost controlling capacities of HMO and those of single payer systems like, for example, Canada is really stark. And HMOs are much closer to private insurance administration systems in this country than they are to countries that have single payer systems. And finally, in a sense, since it does not include a pay-as-you're-able system of financing the whole cost of this, I'm not sure if the word regressive financing is quite the one that I would have chosen, but at least at the very least, it's not a progressive financing system. It's not a completely equitable financing system for these. Okay. In contrast, how am I doing here? Let me just speed up. In contrast, the single payer proposal, a la the system of Canada, which has some virtues, in my opinion. The features of it would be that it would provide universal and comprehensive coverage. Under the Canadian system, just about all types of health care are covered, also dental care, mental health care, long-term care, etc. So everybody essentially would have the same level of care. There would be some things that would not be covered. Plastic surgery of the cosmetic type, tummy tucks and facelifts, would not be covered. Probably it would not cover some frills in certain hospitals. If you wanted to have steak tartare every evening as part of your hospital meal, I'm sure that we probably would not be able to cover that under a national health program. There would be, you know, certain things like that that probably would not be covered. But in essence, the Canadian system covers everything that medical experts or that public health experts consider to be important or proven or efficacious medical procedures and benefits.
Do they have to kind of like wait in line for what's considered?
Yeah, CUSE is an issue. Let me answer that, Rena. There's been a lot made of CUES in this country. Actually, let me read this. This is a cartoon, which I'm going to make this into a slide one of these days here, but it's a cartoon, Sylvia, by Nicole Hollander. Perhaps some of you are familiar with this cartoonist. But she tends to, the style of the cartoon tends to be hyperbole. And she's talking to one of her friends and she says, "Did you know that pregnant women in Canada have to wait 10 months for a bed on the maternity ward? Well, I heard that they do heart transplants there on an outpatient basis with no anesthetic and you can't even pick your own doctor." "Well, I never," cried Irma, crossing her eyes in horror. I mean, I think that degree of hyperbole is to some extent the propaganda that we receive in this country about how the system in Canada works. It's true that there are queues in Canada, there are lines, there are waits. And the ones that have been most publicized are waits for coronary artery bypass grafts, heart surgery in Ontario during 1987 and 1988. And it's true at that point in that province, they've got 9 hospitals that do major heart surgery. And each of those hospitals had significant delays and waits. At that point, there was a political hue and cry, which was heard most audibly in this country, truthfully, but was clearly heard in Canada as well. And the provincial health administration got together with those hospitals and devised a system to correct the problem. And so by 1991, essentially the waits had been reduced down to a much more acceptable level. And is not considered, it's not considered to be a problem in Canada anymore for that particular procedure.
Excuse me, I'm very interested in this because I've heard that same argument and I'm going to have to leave and catch a bus. Did you say that it is not a significant problem?
In that particular procedure, it's no longer really considered to be a problem at all. But one of the things to say is that there are some waits for some types of high-tech procedures of several varieties in Canada. And those waits are almost always for individuals who are in stable condition, who, for example, need their heart bypass operation eventually, but they're doing okay right now. They need it to extend their life, but it's not going to make any medical difference, any survival difference, whether they get that bypass operation now or whether they get it 2 or 3 months from now.
Well, some of these things that we've read have really been kind of exaggerated.
That's right. They're definitely exaggeration. A lot of that propaganda has been put out by the American Medical Association and also by private insurance companies in this country because they've realized that that's an effective way of scaring Americans off from this process. One thing to say about that, though, is that in this country, you know, one of the things to realize is that in this country, we ration care in the most draconian way that you possibly could. We ration it on the basis of ability to pay. And that's not a very rational or economically viable, or certainly it's not a very moral way to ration care. And it seems to me that for some procedures, especially very expensive procedures, that you have to have some way of deciding who's going to get those procedures when. And it seems to me that a much more moral and economically and medically reasonable approach to that is to set up some waiting lists for some types of procedures. I don't think that you want to allow people to get significantly sicker or allow people to have, you know, to die while they're waiting for a procedure. And if that happens, it's a problem. For the most part, that has not been the case in Canada. The one exception, or the most loudly talked about exception, was this situation in Ontario with heart bypass operations that they've now taken care of and fixed. Many people say that at least some degree of waiting does have a place in a healthcare system, and that maybe that is a good way to some extent to control the access to high-tech and highly expensive procedures. So I think, you know, there's some truth to that, but not to the degree that it's been exaggerated in this country.
That sounds a lot more humane than turning a woman away from a hospital.
Agreed. Yeah.
And now she's going to suffer for the rest of her life if she has one.
Yeah, that's right. There's no co-pays or deductibles in the Canadian system and in the bill in the Senate that I'm going to close with here. Hospitals' capital operating budgets are separated from their capital budgets. This is important because how much they're allowed to spend on new wings or major machinery determines what their operating budgets is going to be in the future. And these are the sorts of things that are excess in our system that we've got too much of. We've got too much space, too many beds in hospitals. We've got too many, you know, high-tech MRI scanners, things like that. And so by separating out what a hospital is spending per year to care for patients and to run itself as it currently is from new buildings, new bricks, new metal, is an important cost control feature. There's a single public payer. In the Canadian system, the public payer is each province. It's not the federal government. So each province, or in this country, it would be each state, administers the system. And finally, there's public accountability because it's a democratically controlled system. It's a political system. One of the things that many health economists say is that when it comes to health, that the marketplace diffuses issues and that a public-run system actually has the ability to focus issues. And I think the Ontario heart bypass situation was an example of that. When that became apparent in the press, political resources were quickly sort of, the fire was lit under the public administration and under the politicians of Ontario, and they quickly got that problem fixed. And I think that, it's clear that with our current market approach, that we have a lot of trouble getting things fixed with our healthcare system in this country.
Wouldn't the second and last one be really jeopardize the thing when you get to states as Mississippi and so on?
Well, here's how they do that in Canada. Essentially, they make certain minimum requirements for states, the same way that we do for Medicaid and Medicare. And some of their minimum requirements is that everybody's got to be covered, that it has to be comprehensive, and if you include those two requirements, you're not going to allow much leeway for states to at least skimp on patient benefits. It may be true that some states have more trouble with efficient administration, but again, I think that if that's the case, it's going to become apparent in a democratic system, and so the public's going to raise a hue and cry, particularly if Mississippi's doing a lot poorer compared to, say, Washington or, wherever.
Is the private insurance lobby what's really holding this back?
A lot of it is, yeah. The private insurance lobby is a major political force, and then I think it's fair to say that a significant portion of the American American physicians are holding it back, although that's changing in a rapid hurry. When I first started thinking and talking about this, it was a little bit lonely out there. I mean, myself and an organization that I belonged to, but I didn't feel like I was in the majority in any way. And I think now things are starting to go in the other direction. And I'm about to go over here. Okay. In a single payer system, physicians could be paid essentially as they are now, either with a simple, basically per head system, per physician if they're working in HMOs, or through their institution's budget if they're working out of hospitals or major medical centers, university medical centers. Hospitals, again, would basically remain privately owned, but they would be prohibited from being for profit. So what we would continue to have would be the advantages of having, for example, church run or nonprofit run hospitals, and there are some significant advantages to that, but they would not be profit making enterprises with stockholders, etc. For example, Humana is an example that would have to change if this system went into effect. They would get a global operating budget and a separate capital budget that would be controlled by the public, by the government, or by a commission established by the government in each state, which is similar actually to what some states are already trying for with permit systems for new construction of hospitals. Basically the same thing. In addition, a single payer system would allow us a better mechanism of taking care of long-term care benefits. And a number of people that have discussed the importance of community-based long-term care and home care and support for family members and other informal caregivers. And I think it would be easier to build those into a long-term care system. Although some individuals who are proposing employer mandate systems are also looking at long-term care benefits as well, but again, it's a lot more complicated when you've got 800 or 1,000 private insurers, as we do in this country, to try and administer this kind of stuff.
Are either of the parties looking any of this thing into their planks?
Yeah. Let me just finish. This is satisfaction. I was hoping Roman was going to be here today because he asked about this at one other point of how physicians in Canada view the system. actually, this, I'm sorry, this is the quality of it, that the patients in general in Canada are seen more often and get more access to service than we do on average in this country. And that if anything, they have just as many, if not more, high-tech procedures in Canada where appropriate per capita than we do. In other words, Canada continues to be a leading innovator in medical technology just as the US is. This is about public perceptions of healthcare, and I'm not going to go through this too much except to say that Canadians like their healthcare system a lot and we don't like ours very much at all. and these are polls that were asked of the Canadians. I went through this before. The Canadians are 95% in favor of their system, whereas Americans would, by two-thirds of Americans would probably prefer a Canadian system when it's explained to them in a couple sentences, and only about a third still think they prefer the US. And this was 3 years ago, and the explanation of the Canadian system was not very good, and this was at the height of all the talk about queues in Canada. So, and here's how the US, at least one segment of it by Harris Poll in 88, thinks that that long-term care is important and that it ought to be funded by the government. And it's probable that if we get better long-term care in this country, that at least that component is going to require some increased funding. Because right now we don't fund long-term care very well at all, so it's a little hard to sort of, you know, have a cost-neutral system for that. But most Americans are willing to pay for more long-term care, it seems. Here's how physicians view it. Essentially, physician incomes for primary care specialties like family practice, internal medicine, pediatrics, psychiatry, are roughly equivalent in the U.S. and Canada. And interestingly, in this country, physicians favor, a majority of physicians favor some form of national health insurance, although not necessarily a single payer system. But at least about 5 years ago, 3/4 of physicians thought other physicians didn't favor it, which is one of the things that the AMA seems to be still be feeding off of. And so here's who benefits in our system, in my opinion, the insurance companies, as evidenced by John Hancock and the Prudential Towers and the skyline of Boston. So that's the slideshow. Let me just show you real quickly what I've got on the board here. Where we are right now, and then I'll let everybody go to lunch. Since it's a small group, I can go over for a second. Can I? Okay. This is the single payer system that I've been talking about a la Canada, and currently, back in March actually, Paul Wellstone, Senator of Minnesota, along with Howard Metzenbaum and Paul Simon, who's a good Lutheran, introduced Senate Bill 2320, which is essentially a single payer system like Canada's. similar criteria proposed by, this should not be Dellums, this should be Conyers, I'm sorry. John Conyers, who's the head of the Government Operations Committee in the House of Representatives, the chair of that, how these different proposals would stack up. Universal care, the single payer system would do that. That is to say, everybody would be in cover, would be covered, including those who are changing jobs or moving or whatever. And in most of the employer mandate proposals, that would also be the case. Although some of them would still have an occasional loophole for people who are changing jobs. The single payer system would be comprehensive and therefore would take care of the problem of underinsurance or partial insurance. I think it's pretty fair to say that most of the employer mandate proposals would not do that, and that most of them would define a sort of a basic level of benefits that would not be what you or I would choose if we had our choice of healthcare benefits. And that employers would continue to offer better plans than this to attract employees, but those who did not have employers who were offering healthcare would be a part of the public pool, and they would have only the benefit, basic benefit package. So in essence, under the employer mandate system, we would still have a two-tier system of medical care. And I think people, you know, differ as to whether they consider that moral or not. Personally, I think it is a problem. Cost control would be a major advantage of the single payer system, and employer mandate proposals making a crack at cost control, usually by expanding or relying more on managed care and HMOs. But I think my estimate of this is that they're likely to fail, because right now HMOs aren't doing that much better than our private insurance system at managed care. Under a single provider system, you'd have free choice of physicians. That would not be the case under this. I think it controls, the single payer systems control administrative waste, and I don't think that employer mandate systems make an attempt at doing that very well. And then there's some other features, for example, how it's financed. Potentially, employer mandate proposals could be progressively financed, but that's not an element of all of them, and not a key feature, whereas the single payer system would probably rely on a progressive income tax instead of whatever all of us are paying for health insurance at the present time. So you would be paying health insurance premiums, or your employer wouldn't. Instead, you know, you'd have that much more money that would be going to income tax to pay for the whole system. Generally, this is conceived of as being a cost-neutral system. We wouldn't be paying any more for healthcare as a nation than we are now. And by eliminating a lot of administrative excess, we'd be getting more people covered at the same time, and we'd be getting everybody better covered. A couple other issues that we raised yesterday, how would these systems do on quality control and medical efficacy? Criteria, judgments based on medical efficacy. Well, I think, you know, both systems have some hope for that, and that certainly needs to look at. And the Wellstone bill in the Senate, I think, probably needs to be souped up in that respect. But in a sense, that's something that is a little bit separate from some of the rest of this. And whether they promote self-care or prevention or not, I think is still an issue for both of these. The Wellstone bill actually has some measures that help with that. Most of the employer mandate proposals don't look at it. So I am sorry that I went over. Seems to be the way to do this. Thank you very much for being here. And it's a pleasure talking about it. You're the last of the Mohicans. I guess I covered too much.
Even, you know, I was here on Wednesday, even that was good to review.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wasn't expecting to do half of what I did today, but then I thought, well, there are going to be new people here today. So then I thought, well,
oh, that's fine.
I don't know. If I was coming to hold it again, I would design it somewhat differently so that I could sort of. do single sessions on everything, but I guess.
Did I do what I was supposed to do?
Yeah, you did very, very much.
The man at our visual aids department says if you don't, move the machine, it's not necessarily cool, your lamp bulb will last longer.
Oh, is that right?
Just as long as you don't jostle it.
Huh, okay. Well, that's great.
Well, thanks.
That's the science of having how it replaced how many bulbs.
She left the scissors over here.
She surely did.
I suppose that's hers, I'll take it to her.
Well, I'm sorry that we didn't have a bigger crowd today.
Well, that's your rep.
I think that's what we can expect from here on out.
I think that's true. So who exactly is in the village right now? I mean, without.
Well, the elder hostel still here, but they had a thing from 11 to 12:30.
Well, you know, they haven't been really attending anybody's sessions during the last week. I mean, there's an occasional.
There are a lot of hikes going on and freebies.
It's a different group from last week.
I guess that's fine.
Well, it's kind of hard for us to figure out, see, because we weren't, next week, we don't know what the situation is, but we'll have to have somebody balancing, so you're offering two things all the time.
Oh.
And see, because they were invited to Elder Hostel, they.
So I'll be taking a crack, I think, at 5 or 6 next week myself.
You know what you might want to do, though, if you have something that looks wrong, but